All right, I'm going to be brief. I'm very honored to introduce our today's speakers, Dr. William Sagota. He
is a biophysicist. I am Sean, a biophysicist throughout his training life. Can you hear me now?
Oh, there is something. Can you hear me now? Yeah. So he has been a long time ion biophysicist since early days. He did his PhD with Dr. Aldrich in Stanford. That was back sometime in 1989 he finished. Then he, of course, in those days, they were working in the early stages of understanding the diversity of ion channels. So he was working with muscle cells from Drosophila and just understanding how potassium channels from the muscles gate and the diversity of those channels. In those days, Dr. Aldrich also was developing a huge effort in trying to understand the structure and function of ion channels, so Bill decided to stay and do a postdoctoral fellowship with him, and they, in together with Dr. Hoche, they performed one of the most beautiful structure and function work ever done, and that was to understand the basics of N-type inactivation mechanism. He moved to Seattle, to the University of Washington in Seattle, as an assistant professor, and he has climbed all the academic ladder of both the department and also the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which he is now a full investigator. Throughout these years as an independent scientist, he has focused just in one ion channel, which is amazing in a scientist to be so focused. But he has done a beautiful and brilliant work in understanding how cyclic nucleotide-regulated ion channels gate, how they work, how they function, and he has used a combination of crystallography and a structural function work. His work is so excellent that he has been recognized by our community in more than one occasion, in many occasions, but I think perhaps the most important one is the one that he will receive in a week in our Biophysical Society meeting, because he was awarded this year a KC Cole Award, which is an award named and honored Dr. Cole, KC Cole, who was a member of our institution. He had a lab here at NIH. Therefore, because that award is so special to us, I would like to, in the name of all of us as an institution, to congratulate you for such an important recognition, which you well deserve it, and we thank you for coming and share with us your work. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Miguel. Can everybody hear me? So first I'd like to thank Miguel for inviting me. I haven't been back to the NIH in a number of years, and I just love coming back here to see old friends. It's really an amazing place. So I'd like to tell you today about our experiments to try to understand something about the molecular mechanisms by which ion channels work. And my lab is particularly interested in trying to understand how it is that an ion channel, a membrane protein that allows ions to pass, how it is that ion channel is able to open and close its ion conductive pore in response to various stimuli. And the ion channel, the family of ion channels that we chose for these studies are the cyclic nucleotide regulated channels that are shown in this slide. So this is a large family of diverse ion channels with diverse physiological roles. So the C and G channels, for example, produce the primary electrical signals in your photoreceptors and your olfactory receptors and some of your taste receptors in response to those stimuli. They're sensory receptor channels. Another member of this family are the HCN channels. These are the channels that produce repetitive firing behavior in your neurons and also in your heart, in the sinoatrial node of your heart. They control the rate of your heartbeat. The etheragogo-like channels, these channels are probably best known for the human ERG, the so-called HERG channel, which is important for long QT syndrome. It's one of the channels that's mutated in long QT syndrome and is also the target of many drugs. And there's also plant channels that are a member of this group. So the channels themselves are quite diverse in their physiological roles. They're also diverse in their ionic selectivities. But the one thing they all have in common is they've all been reported to be activated by the direct binding of cyclic nucleotides, cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP, to an intercellular domain in the channel. And a few different examples of that are shown in this slide. So on the right, so these are recordings made from Xenopus oocytes. They're inside-out patch recordings, and so we have access to the cytoplasmic face of these patches, and therefore we can just apply cyclic nucleotides directly onto the cytoplasmic face of these channels and record the current that flows through the channels that are in our little membrane patch. So those currents are shown for the CNGA1 channel, the channel that's expressed in rod photoreceptors on the right. As you can see, these channels are not open at all in the absence of cyclic nucleotide, but in the presence of cyclic nucleotide, they exhibit an open probability near 1. So this is cyclic GMP here. Cyclic GMP produces about a 9 kilocalorie per mole or so stabilization of the open state in these channels when it binds to an intracellular domain of the channel. The channels themselves are voltage independent. They just depend on cyclic nucleotide binding. HCN channels, on the other hand, are actually voltage dependent. These channels are open in response to membrane hyperpolarization, but they're also activated by cyclic nucleotide. So you can see that the application of cyclic AMP shown here, the channels open faster and more completely in the presence of cyclic AMP than they do in the absence. Okay? The middle class of channels, this is a sea urchin HCN channel homolog, has behavior that's sort of intermediate between the CNG channels and the HCN channels. It's not open hardly at all in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. In fact, these channels rapidly inactivate in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. However, in the presence of cyclic nucleotide, there's a large increase in the current, like CNG channels, but the opening is voltage dependent, like HCN channels. So it's kind of got an intermediate gating behavior. So this similarity in their functional properties, the fact that they're all activated by cyclic nucleotides, is also reflected in a similarity in their structure. So these channels are all members of the voltage activated family of channels. That is, they all consist of 4 subunits around a centrally located pore. Only 2 of the subunits are shown here. Each one of the subunits contains 6 transmembrane segments, and the region between the last 2 transmembrane segments and the last transmembrane segment itself, the S6, form the ion conducting pore. The one feature that makes this family of channels unique among the voltage-activated channels is their carboxy-terminal region here contains the region shown in blue, which is a cyclic nucleotide binding domain. This sequence is similar to the cyclic nucleotide binding domain one finds in cyclic GMP or cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinases and various transcription factors that bind cyclic nucleotide. And they also have sequence similarity in this region that connects the cyclic nucleotide binding domain to the pore. This is what we call the C-linker region. So all the members of this family have a considerable sequence similarity in this carboxy terminal fragment. So work in my lab has really been focused on trying to understand how it is that the binding of cyclic nucleotide to this domain ultimately opens a pore that's located some distance away in this protein. That is, what is the nature of this allosteric conformational change that these proteins undergo when a ligand binds down here and a pore opens up here? So to try to understand that, you can think of that allosteric conformational change as occurring in one of 2 different ways. So there's kind of 2 different models for how that activation might occur. So the first one is probably the one that most of you are thinking about when you think of an allosteric conformational change, which is that when the carboxy terminus diagrammed here binds ligand, the little green triangle, that exerts work on the channel, which pulls open the pore. Okay, so that would be one way in which the binding of ligand could open the pore, is if the binding domain, the liganded binding domain exerts work on the channel that opens the pore. But as it turns out, that's not the only way that you could get ligand activation. Another way is if it's actually the APO form of the carboxy terminal domain, the unliganded form, that is actually exerting work on the pore to keep the pore closed, and that when the ligand binds, it removes that inhibition by the carboxy terminal main and the pore pops open. Okay? So either the active component, or it could be something in between. So either the active component is the ligand form pulling the channel open, or the unliganded form pulling the channels closed. And there's a simple test that one could do to test which one of these it is. These are experiments that were motivated by experiments that were done by Steve Siegelbaum in HCN channels. We did them, you'll see, in SPIH channels, where the results are more clear. The simple test is to just delete off this carboxy terminal domain. In the top model, if you delete off the carboxy terminal domain, there's nothing to do work to hold the channel open, and so the channels will always be closed. They'll always behave as if cyclic nucleotide is not around. Okay? In the bottom model, though, if you delete off the cyclic nucleotide binding domain, it removes that inhibition on the closed channel, and the channels will behave as if the cyclic nucleotide is always around, even if there's no cyclic nucleotide around. So you can imagine either one of these scenarios being the case. And so we did that simple experiment. We did it, as I said, in these SPIH channels where there's this large increase in the current in response to cyclic nucleotide. So just to remind you, in the absence of cyclic nucleotide, these channels undergo a rapid inactivation process, so they exhibit very little current in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. And cyclic AMP just removes that inactivation in these channels. So if we just delete off that carboxy terminal domain, we find that, sure enough, these channels actually no longer undergo the inactivation process. They now exhibit a robust current, even in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. And I'm not showing it here, but if you add cyclic nucleotide, it doesn't change anything. Not surprising, because you delete it off the cyclic nucleotide binding domain. But what this tells us is that this fragment of the channel, this carboxy terminal piece, is perhaps not behaving like you might think in the beginning. It's not that the liganded form of the channel is pulling the channel open. It's that the APO form of the carboxy terminal piece, the unligated carboxy terminal piece, is actually holding the channels closed. So that's important to keep in mind sort of when you're viewing, when you're looking at the mechanism for how these things might work. So in an effort to try to understand how it is that the binding of ligand produces a conformational change that opens the pore, we were interested in getting the structure, particularly the X-ray crystallographic structure of the carboxy terminal piece of these channels. And starting about 6 years ago or so, I went to Eric Guo's lab, who was then at Columbia University, on sabbatical to do that very thing. And in fact, to the great help of Eric and a graduate student in his lab, Nelson Olivier, we were able to get the crystal structure of the carboxy terminal piece of HCN while bound to different ligands. We've now done a similar experiment with the SPIH channel. So in my lab, the SPIH channel, which has somewhat different gating behavior, as I showed you, is about 60% similar to the HCN channel. We've determined the crystal structure of that. This just shows the piece that we obtain the structure of. It begins immediately after the last transmembrane segment, includes the C linker and the cyclic nucleotide binding domain, and is cleaved right after the cyclic nucleotide binding domain. You can tell I'm still a budding crystallographer because I still like to show my crystals. And we were able to solve this structure using molecular replacement from our HCN. We obtained it at 1.9 angstroms. And the result is shown on this slide. So like the HCN channel, this SPIH structure was a four-fold symmetric tetramer. And so if you view it from the side and orient it as it would be with respect to the transmembrane segments on the channel, it's got sort of two domains. It's got this top part, which is the C linker that connects the cyclic nucleotide binding domain to the pore, is located on the top. And on the bottommost portion is the cyclic nucleotide binding domain itself. And in fact, the cyclic nucleotide binding domain, with its bound cyclic AMP in this case, is located at the very bottommost portion of the structure, some 50 angstroms away from where the pore would be. So this helps to frame the problems that we're interested in, which is how is it that the binding of cyclic nucleotide way down here propagates up through 50 angstroms of protein to open a pore that's located much higher. So if you view this just a single subunit, you can see that the C linker consists of about 6 alpha helices here, and it's the source of all of the inner subunit interactions that are occurring in this tetramer. So all the inner subunit interactions are formed by the C linker piece. The cyclic nucleotide binding domains are just hanging almost completely independent of each other below the C linker. The cyclic nucleotide binding domain consists primarily of this 8-stranded beta roll structure. It's sort of a jelly-like arrangement with a jelly roll-like arrangement with a cyclic nucleotide bound inside the hole of the jelly roll and forming interactions both with the beta roll and with this helix, the C helix. So it's easy to confuse this. This is the C linker up here, and this is the C helix down here. Unfortunately, they end up with the same kind of name. In any case, we think it's the interactions with this C helix that ultimately is the trigger that tells this channel, yes, the cyclic nucleotide is bound. And somehow that conformational change is propagated up through the structure and ultimately produces a conformational change that allows the pore to open. So when we compared this structure of SPIH to HCN, what we found was that the structures are very similar to each other. So even though these things are only about 60% identical, and even though they actually have quite different functional properties, in one case the cyclic nucleotide shifts activation, in the other case it removes inactivation, the actual structure of the ligand binding domains and the C linker are virtually identical. And to tell you the truth, I can't remember which one is the HCN and which one's SPIH, but it doesn't really matter. There's only about 1 angstrom of root mean squared difference in the alpha carbons between the two structures. So then it appears that I can't learn anything about the movement directly from just looking at the structure of a homolog that actually gates differently. My lab has been interested in trying to understand how not just what the static structure of this piece is, but how is it that the structure moves? How is it that the structure changes conformation in response to binding ligand? And to be able to answer that question, we instead turn to a technique that would allow us to get some dynamic structural information. So it wouldn't just provide high-resolution structures of one state, but actually could had the potential to give us information about the dynamics of how things move. And those techniques are all based in fluorescence and fluorescence resonance energy transfer, or FRET. So I'll spend the rest of the talk telling you about a few different FRET approaches which we've taken to try to look at how this carboxy terminal piece moves associated with the opening of the channel. So some of those are summarized on this slide. So to be able to do these, so the idea is to be able to get a low-resolution picture of structural changes in this piece, and to be able to map those low-resolution pictures on what we have as a high-resolution structure, and to be able to correlate that with the functional properties that are occurring dynamically at the same time. So in order to be able to do that, we had to attach fluorescent probes onto the structure, and we did that in one of two ways, either by attaching GFP, obviously a large fluorescent molecule. Frequently, we attached it just at the end of the C helix here. Surprisingly, that doesn't affect channel function at all. You can't tell that it's there. The other way we attach fluorophores is to introduce cysteines at several different positions in the carboxy terminal fragment. And then modify those cysteines with a fluorescent cystine modifying reagent. So these are we made these channels otherwise cysteineless, so we can introduce a single cysteine and can modify it very specifically with a fluorescent cysteine modifying reagent. So this allows us to look at movements in a couple different ways. We can look at FRET between these fluorophores and dyes that are resident in the membrane. So this allows us to look at movements of this carboxy terminal piece that are orthogonal to the membrane. We can look at intramolecular fret. We can look at fret between two different fluorophores that are both attached to the channel, look at movements that are occurring within the channel itself. And the third thing I'll show you is we can look at, it's not a fret-based mechanism, but a fluorescence quenching mechanism that allows us to look at very short-range interactions, specific interactions that we detect in the X-ray crystal structure, and look at the dynamics of those. So I'll go through each of those. To perform these experiments, we use a technique which we coined patch clamp fluorimetry. And all patch clamp fluorimetry really is patch clamp, inside-out patch clamp recording, as it's been developed a number of years ago, but at the same time recording the fluorescence of those patches. So the way it works is illustrated here. We take an otherwise cysteineless channel and introduce a single cysteine into it. And then we record from those channels using the inside-out configuration of the patch clamp technique. So this recording does two things for us. It allows us to visualize, either with the current or with fluorescence, the modification of that of each cysteine. So while we're modifying the cysteine, we can actually record it and make sure the modification is occurring and is complete. But it also allows us to simultaneously record the current flowing through the channel. So we can measure once the cysteine has been modified with a fluorophore, we can measure structural changes in the channel by measuring the fluorescence. At the same time, we can measure functional changes in the channel by measuring the current using the inside-out configuration of the patch clamp technique. So shown on the bottom here is just an example of one of these inside-out patches. And here the channels have been modified with a fluorophore. And what you can see is this is an inside-out patch. Most people probably think an inside-out patch forms at the opening of the pipette, but in fact, patch clampers have known for a long time that inside-out patches actually form as omega shapes inside the pipette. So in fact, this is the patch right here. This is the part we're recording the ion channels from, and it's also the part that that we've labeled with fluorophore. And you can see that the labeling is specific on the membrane because when I blow on the patch, you can see it blows out this little piece of membrane. So you can see that clearly the labeling is on the membrane itself. In fact, the harder I blow, the more it pushes it out, unless I blow too hard, and then it blows it out of the pipette. That's why postdocs don't like doing experiments with me anymore. But before that, what you could see was that there was obviously fluorescence in that patch, and we can record that fluorescence and any changes in that fluorescence that might be occurring during some sort of dynamic process of the carboxy terminus. As I said, we label specific sites on the channel, and the site that is our favorite one to label, I'll be showing you several examples today, is a cysteine that's actually an endogenous cysteine that's normally present in these channels at position 481. So we've removed all the other cysteines, and in fact, we had to put this one back in because we had removed this one as well. But the cysteine at 481 is located at the junction between the C linker on the top here and the second nucleotide binding domain on the bottom here. It's right at that junction. And the reason this is our favorite cysteine to modify is it undergoes a state-specific modification. And you can see that on the right part of this slide. So if you apply a maleimide, which reacts with cysteines, either in the absence or the presence of cyclic nucleotide, cyclic GMP, you can see so if we just look at the current on the bottom graph, you can see when we apply that maleimide in the absence of cyclic nucleotide, it has no effect on the current. But when we apply it in the presence of cyclic nucleotide, there is a potentiation of the current, which is reflecting the fact that we've now modified that site. In other words, this site at C481 does not react with maleimide in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. It undergoes a state-dependent rearrangement that allows it to only be accessible in the presence of cyclic nucleotide. So if you look at fluorescence, in this case, we're actually using a maleimide that's attached to a dye, Alexa 488. What you can see is that even though we're not modifying any channels in the absence of cyclic nucleotide, there is an increase in fluorescence. And then there's a further increase, of course, when we modify the channels. But this tells us that there's a background modification that's occurring, that some cysteine other than the one in the channel is actually being modified here in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. And more importantly, though, the fact that this undergoes state-dependent modification allows us to block that background modification. So for most of the experiments I'll be showing you, what we've done is apply a non-fluorescent maleimide in the absence of cyclic nucleotide, block all of the cysteines that might be available in the absence of cyclic nucleotide, and then apply a fluorescent cyclic nucleotide, fluorescent maleimide in the presence of cyclic nucleotide. Okay? So that gives us very specific labeling just of that cysteine at C481. So, I also want to point out that when we record the fluorescence, we generally don't record it. We generally don't record just the images, but we record the emission spectra from the patch. And that's done using a simple spectrograph, and that's shown here. So here's our example of our pipette with a little fluorescence patch in it. And this fluorescence patch is then projected onto a slit here, and the slit is then projected onto a diffraction grating. The diffraction grating then separates the light by its wavelength in this dimension. It leaves space in this direction, but it separates the light by its wavelength in this dimension. So one can just perform a line scan at the level of the patch right here and get the data like that shown on the right. You can then see in one shot, you get a whole emission spectra for that fluorophore. And you'll see why that's useful here in a moment. So, as I said, one of the things we were interested in is, are there any movements of this piece relative to the membrane, orthogonal to the membrane? And to do that, we made use of a membrane-resident dye recently popularized by Pancho Bezzania and colleagues called dipicrolamine. So dipicrolamine is a dye, it's a negatively charged dye that inserts into the membrane. The absorption of that dye, shown as this dotted line here, overlaps with the emission of several different popular dyes. In other words, this dye can serve as a fret acceptor for these different fluorophores. These are donor fluorophores, and they will be able to exhibit fret with dipicrolamine in the membrane as a fret acceptor. So we can actually perform these experiments measuring the fret efficiency quite simply, and that's shown here. So we first record the emission spectra. In this case, it's of a CNG channel with GFP attached, but we've also done it with small molecule fluorophores. And here's the emission spectra in the absence of dipicrolamine. So then, because we're recording from these channels and inside-out patches, we can just directly apply dipicrolamine to the bath solution. So when you do that, what you find is that the dipicrolamine, if it's close to the GFP, will exhibit fret with the GFP. From the perspective of the donor fluorophore, GFP, that's gonna cause its fluorescence to be quenched by the dipicrolamine. So in the presence of dipicrolamine, what you end up seeing is a smaller fluorescence intensity, but with the same shaped emission spectra. It doesn't change the position. It just simply decreases the amount because some of the energy of the GFP is now being donated to the dipicrolamine instead of being emitted as a photon. Okay. Furthermore, by just measuring the amount of quenching you see with dipicrolamine, you can directly calculate what the fret efficiency is, which is a number that's related to how close the proximity of the GFP relative to the dipicrolamine. So we performed this kind of experiment with fluorophores attached at several different positions, and the results are shown here. So this is with fluorophores with GFP attached to the end of the channel or at the end of the C helix or at position C481. And you can see as we move, in this case, closer and closer to the membrane, the amount of quenching we saw got greater and greater. So that's what we would have expected if the orientation of that carboxy terminal piece was as I showed you it was, with the amino terminus of the carboxy terminal piece on next to the membrane and the second nucleotide binding domain most distant from the membrane. So when you're attached to the second nucleotide binding domain, the fret efficiency is less. There's less quenching. Furthermore, if we attach a different dye instead of 488 to C41, we attach Alexa 568 to C41. That has less spectral overlap with dipicrolamine, and so we would expect less quenching. And in fact, we observe less quenching. So that's consistent with this quenching being a result of a fret mechanism, like I've already described. So this encouraged us then that our structure is more or less correct, and that we have it oriented relative to the membrane correctly. So what we were really interested in, though, is there movement? Is this carboxy terminal piece moving relative to the membrane? Well, before we tested that, we wanted to make sure that this technique would allow us to see movements. And with dipicrolamine, there's a simple way of looking for movements, which is because the dipicrolamine is charged, it's got a negative charge, you can actually move the dipicrolamine in the membrane by changing the voltage. That's shown here. So if we make the voltage more positive, the dipicrolamine will move from the outer leaflet to the inner leaflet. And if the fret we're measuring is sensitive to the distance between the GFP donor and the dipicrolamine, then we should see quenching of the fluorescence as we make the voltage more positive. And that is, in fact, what we see. So that's shown on the left here. Shown here are just the raw current records from minus 60 millivolts to plus 60 millivolts. And what you can see is that as we made the voltage more and more positive, the currents got dimmer and dimmer. Okay, so that's suggesting that as we make the voltage more positive, the dipicrolamines are getting more and more abundant on the cytoplasmic leaflet of the membrane, and that furthermore the fact that that's being picked up in GFP's fluorescence says that this technique is now quite sensitive to telling us what the difference, what the distance is between GFP and the membrane. So then, of course, we want to know what happens if instead of changing voltage, we change cyclic nucleotide levels. We see, can we change the conformation of this domain? Does that change the distance relative to the membrane? Before I show you that, let me just show you. This is the data quantified from the last slide. These are the emission spectra at different voltages and showing the voltage dependence. So now, does cyclic nucleotide change the distance? And to our surprise, the answer is no. This was a surprise to us because we and others had proposed that actually the cyclic nucleotide binding domain must move away from the membrane as the channel opens and closes. It was thought, for reasons that I won't get into, that first helix of the C linker must straighten out as the channel gets open, which would almost certainly move that whole cyclic nucleotide binding domain a good 10 angstrom. So we should have been able to pretty easily see that. In fact, we don't see that at all. So shown on the left is the emission spectra in the absence and the presence of cyclic nucleotide. We know the cyclic nucleotide is activating the channels. It's producing a very large current with channels with a very high open probability. And yet the emission spectra completely superimposed. There's no movement of these emission spectra, of course, recorded in the presence of dipicrolamine. So there appears to be no movement at several positions we measure, either GFP attached to the end of the channel, at the end of the C helix, or at C481, with a couple different dyes at C481. So this surprised us a little bit. And it either meant that if there was a movement, the movement was very small, or it meant that the movement was not orthogonal to the membrane, the movement was in the plane of the membrane, that was parallel to the membrane. So to look for movements parallel to the membrane, we instead looked for intramolecular fret. So intramolecular, we attached the GFP onto the end of the C helix here, and then introduced cysteines, shown at just one position here, but at several different positions in this C linker, in this carboxy terminal piece, and then looked for fret between GFP and the dye attached here. And this just shows that there's considerable spectral overlap between the Alexa 568, if we attach Alexa 568 here, between the emission of GFP and the absorption of Alexa 568. So we should be able to see a significant fret signal. So the way that experiment works is shown here. So here again is the bright field image of the patch. So we're recording from a patch, a channel here that's got GFP attached at the end of the C helix. And so if we just excise the patch without doing anything, we can immediately see fluorescence in that patch. And if we look at the spectral image, what you can see is this black trace here. It emits just like GFP. Okay. And then what we do is apply the cysteine reactive fluorophore, Alexa 568. And when one does that, the patch gets a lot brighter. And when you look at the spectral image, you can see that not only do we have GFP's fluorescence, but a second hump appears in the spectral image, which you can easily see as the red bump here. So this is the emission of Alexa 568. But more importantly than the fact that we see an emergence of this Alexa 568 peak, we also see a decrease in the intensity of the GFP peak. So what this says is this Alexa 568, some of it is very close, in very close proximity to that GFP, close enough to be able to exhibit fret with GFP. And then this allows us to do what we did before, which is just to measure that decrease in the intensity of GFP, and that's directly a measure of the fret efficiency between whatever the dye we introduce in Alexa 568 and GFP. Just to show you that this decrease, this is combined from a number of cells, that decrease is really not observed if the channel doesn't have any cysteines. That decrease in fluorescence that we observe is due to the cysteine that we introduced into the channel. So we did that experiment, and we did it with cysteines introduced at a number of different positions in the channel. So this shows four different introduced cysteines into the channel. What you can see is that as we move the positions closer and closer to the membrane, the amount of quenching got less and less. So that's now got the opposite dependence that I showed you with the membrane quenching, but it's exactly what you would expect with the geometry that where we attach the GFP at the bottom end of the channel. So now as we move the fluorophore up, they got to be less and less quenching. Furthermore, we could actually triangulate from the amount of fret we see. We can actually triangulate now what the position of the GFP is. If we factor in the fact that the channel itself is fourfold and we're introducing four GFPs and four fluorophores for each subunit, you can calculate what the fret efficiency is for each position and search for a position of GFP that gives the best fit to all the data. And that position turns out to be right here. So this is exactly where we'd want it to be because we know that we've attached this GFP to the C helix. This is the C helix right here. So the GFP turns out to be more or less like we thought. Ironically, actually not the way we used to draw it. We always drew it as if it was down here, like gravity was working on it or something like that. I don't know, maybe that's natural to do that. But in fact, it turns out not to be down here. It turns out to be more radially distributed relative, which is not a big surprise. But once again, it's closest to 481 and furthest away from these upper residues, like 399 at the bottom of the S6. So this top part just shows that there's good correspondence between the model's predictions of the distance and the experimental predictions of the quenching. So this position actually does a nice job in predicting all four of the fluorescences that we, the fret efficiencies that we see. So now, again, we're interested in how is it, can we actually see movement? Can we see, this is because of the position of this GFP being more radially located, this approach is going to be more sensitive to movements in the radial dimension as opposed to the orthogonal dimension. So can we see movements? And for at least one of those positions, 481, we can, and that's shown here. So this is recordings from a channel at C481, which has a GFP after the C helix. And what we've done is activate the channels with cyclic GMP and just record this emission spectra. Remember, it's a double hump spectra with GFP and the Alexa are the two humps. what you can see is when we put GFP on, I mean cyclic GMP on, the green trace here, there's an increase in the fluorescence of GFP and a decrease in the fluorescence of the Alexa. So this is suggesting that what's happening is that that there is a decrease in the FRET efficiency. So there's less quenching of GFP and more there's more quenching of going the other way around. There's less quenching of GFP is the easiest way to think of it. When you apply cyclic GMP. So that quenching is shown here. We also wanted to look at, that's suggesting that perhaps there is a radial movement, and that radial movement is outward, that either the GFP is moving out, or this Alexa 481 position is moving in, so that now that separation gets to be greater. We then looked at a partial agonist, cyclic AMP. So cyclic AMP is a partial agonist that on these channels is activating just about half of the current that cyclic GMP is activating, even at a saturating concentration. So if we apply, if we look at the FRET with cyclic AMP, what we find is that it's somewhere intermediate between no ligand and cyclic GMP, and that data is quantified here. So you get about half of the fluorescence change with cyclic AMP that you get with cyclic GMP. So this is consistent with the idea that with a partial agonist, it's either possible that the conformational change is occurring, but it's only occurring about half as much or half as far, and so you only see about half the change. Alternatively, and probably more likely, the same conformational change is occurring with cyclic AMP and cyclic GMP, but it's only occurring half the time. So the channel is actually flickering open and closed with cyclic AMP. And as it flickers open and closed, it's spending half the time in the more quenched state and half the time in the less quenched state. And so on average, what one sees with this partial agonist at this position 481 is an intermediate result. So that's interesting. That's something we wouldn't have known otherwise, because now we have a reporter on the channel that's specifically telling us about the movement of that portion of the channel during the opening and closing conformational change. So that effect of cyclic AMP and cyclic GMP on the FRET efficiency was unique to C481. We didn't observe it in the three other positions that we looked at in the C linker. So what that suggests is that we're probably not picking up a movement of the GFP itself. It's probably true that the GFP itself is actually acting in a relatively fixed manner. And we're looking at movements of the channels with these small molecule fluorophores attached to them relative to the GFP. The fact that we saw a decreased quenching means that piece of the channel, this loop here where the C481 is located, is probably moving away from the GFP, which would be located out here somewhere in this picture. The distance is probably increasing. Okay, so the experiments I've shown you now have really been FRET-based. And FRET, you can tell perhaps from some of these results that FRET really has a limitation that I think is reasonably severe, which is that FRET works over very large distances. It really is looking for conformational changes. It can detect very small conformational changes, but it can only detect them if it's a long ways away. So the distance has to be on the order of R0 or on the order of 40 or 50 angstroms in order to be able to see that distance. Otherwise, if you're closer than that, you get just 100% FRET occurring, and you would never be sensitive to small rearrangements. So I would say that's a really big limitation for being able to look at molecular dynamics, that it's not so easy to be able to tell what something is doing when it's 50 angstroms away, when the protein itself is only about 50 angstroms in diameter. Okay, so what I believe is that in order to really be able to get at these conformational changes, what one needs to do is to look at much shorter distance interactions, to be able to look at, for example, some of the salt bridge interactions, for example, that one observes in the in X-ray crystal structure, and to be able to look specifically at the dynamics of those interactions as the channel's opening and closing. Presumably, again, with a fluorescence reporter that could allow us to measure specifically the dynamics of that conformational change as it occurs. So there's a technique out there that allows one to do that. And that technique was really developed by Dave Farrens at OHSU and his colleagues. It's shown here. So this is, the technique is based on a fluorophore called bimane. Bimane means two hands. It's a two five-membered rings attached together. And it's a small molecule of fluorophore, so it's about the size of a tryptophan residue. So bimane has a special property that when it's near a tryptophan residue, the tryptophan residue quenches bimane's fluorescence by this process referred to as photo-induced electron transfer. Okay, so the very interesting thing about this quenching by a nearby tryptophan residue is that it occurs over very short distances. Dave originally estimated, based on studying it in lysozyme, that it works over the range of 5 to 15 angstroms, but it's really occurring substantially at 5 to 10 angstroms. So it's a much shorter distance reporter than FRET, which is reporting distances on the order of 50 angstroms. This allows you; those distances allow you to test really short distance interactions that are occurring in the protein. And so you can just observe this FRET in a cuvette. If you actually record bimane's fluorescence and add increasing concentrations of tryptophan, you can see that it quenches bimane's fluorescence. And that quenching follows a simple Stern-Volmer relation. So those of you who haven't looked at this, this is the standard plot used for plotting quenching data, and the slope of this plot is sort of the inverse of the efficacy or the affinity of the quenching. So if it's higher affinity quenching, the slope is less. So the first thing we wanted to do is to study what happens when we attach bimane to the channel. And we started it first by looking at quenching of the bimane by tryptophan that was in solution, not a tryptophan that's part of the channel, but tryptophan in solution. And that result is shown here. So we attached cysteine reactive bimane to C481, our favorite cysteine, and then studied the quenching of that fluorescent channel by tryptophan in solution, looking at more or less the accessibility of that tryptophan in solution. And we did that either in the absence of cyclic nucleotide or in the presence of cyclic nucleotide. What you can see is that in the presence of cyclic nucleotide, the Stern-Volmer relation is got a lower slope, which reflects the fact that it's got a higher affinity for or a higher efficacy for quenching by tryptophan. And in other words, it appears that at C481, a bimane attached to C481 is more accessible when the channel is open than when the channel's closed. And in fact, that is more or less what we would have expected, because we know that you can only modify C481 when the channel's open than when it's closed. So it makes sense that it's actually more accessible when the channel's open than when it's closed. It also makes sense modification of C481, as I showed you, potentiates the channels. And that's also what you would expect if modification of the open state is more favorable than modification of the closed state. So, of course, what we really want to do is not use this technique to measure accessibility of residues, but instead to measure movement of residues relative to parts of the channel. And so what we did was we introduced tryptophans in this case, at a number of positions relative to that C481. The C481 is in kind of a strategic location. It's right at the boundary between the C linker and the cyclic nucleotide binding domain. So we attached tryptophans at each of these positions, and a bunch more that I'm not showing you, and looked at the dynamics of the quenching of bimane attached at C481 to tryptophans at each one of these positions. You can see the distances that we added them ranged from about 8 angstroms to a little over 15 angstroms. And the result was... For most of the positions, we didn't see any state-dependent quenching. So this is one of those. This is a tryptophan at position 588. Here we're, of course, recording using PET scan fluorimetry, so we can measure the current on the left and the fluorescence on the right. So when we apply cyclic nucleotide, there's a big increase in current. When we take away the cyclic nucleotide, the current goes down. So the red spectra were taken in the presence of cyclic nucleotide, and the black spectra were taken in the absence of cyclic nucleotide. You can see they're basically all the same. There's no state-dependent quenching that we could tell with a tryptophan at position 588. However, I wouldn't be telling you all this if that were true at every position. At one position, there was a very clear state-dependent interaction, and it's our old friend C481. So at C481, whenever we opened the channel, the fluorescence went down. If we closed it again, it went back up. We opened it again, it went back down. Closed it again, it goes back up. So there's a clear increase in quenching in the presence of cyclic nucleotide, cyclic GMP in this case, in the presence of cyclic nucleotide. There's a clear increase in quenching, which suggests that this C481 bimain is moving in closer proximity to this tryptophan at 460. We wanted to measure the cyclic nucleotide dependence for that effect, and that's shown here. So the cyclic nucleotide dependence for the activation of the channel is on the left, focused on just the filled symbols. The other ones are before modification. But you can see that the cyclic GMP dependence for opening of the channel was the same as the cyclic GMP dependence for the quenching of the fluorescence. So that assured us that, in fact, we are looking at the conformational change that involves opening of the channel. Furthermore, the partial agonist cyclic AMP is also had a partial effect on the quenching. Once again, consistent with the idea that this piece, C481, it's the same piece, is actually moving. It's only spent about 50% of its time in an open conformation during when it's activated by a partial agonist cyclic AMP. So then I'll finish up here by just pointing out that those two results, the part I showed in the earlier work using FRET and the part I showed in the later work using tryptophan quenching of bimain, actually come to the same conclusion. And that conclusion is that this loop where C481 is moving when the channel opens closer to this residue, 461, when we attached a tryptophan at at 461 tryptophan, and away from the GFP, which would be located way down in here someplace. So this loop seems to be swinging up somehow or another. We think that this conformation here is probably the closed conformation because the distance that one observes between this tryptophan and C481 is on the order of 15 angstroms. It's really on the outer edge of what we ever could have seen. We could have ever seen quenching from to begin with. So we think as the channel opens, they move much closer together, allowing us to see substantial quenching. So I will stop there and just acknowledge the people who did this work. The early crystallography I showed you on SPIH and the physiology on SPIH were done by Galen Flynn. The FRET experiments I showed you were done by Justin Taraska, a postdoc in the lab. And the tryptophan quenching of bimain was done by Leon Islis, another postdoc in the lab. All of them had the help of the technical assistance of Kevin, Shelley, and Gay. The early experiments on crystallography and still my first person to call whenever I run into a crystallography problem is Eric Guo, who I owe a lot to for helping me with that, and his graduate student, Nelson Olivier. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Essentially,
Yes. So what we've done is anisotropy measurements. Yeah. So So if you do anisotropy, we've done them both with the GFP and with the small molecule fluorophores on the channels, and in both cases, those positions are quite mobile. So we think it's probably not orientation dependent. In fact, my guess is in general that people make too much of a deal of the orientation dependence of fret. It's true that there's a kappa squared term that can be anywhere from 0 to 4, which of course could have a very big effect. But as it turns out, if you start wobbling either of the fret pairs, even a little bit, suddenly that kappa squared term settles to one number. And so my guess is most changes are probably not due to orientation dependence. So that, in combination with the fact that the same movement that can explain the decrease in fret from one end can explain the increase in fret from the other end. So I'm kind of hopeful that it would be a cruel hoax, as Dennis Baylor used to say. It would be a cruel hoax if both of those just happened to involve the same orientation dependence. Yeah, I wish I could do that for you. The reason I can't do it for you, besides showing you one loop moving, is that we really only have one or two points. We really only know a couple places on the channels that are moving. I mean, ultimately that's the goal. That's exactly what I want to be able to do. And I think if we could map, we could get maps such as the one we have with 481, but at a dozen different positions or more even, that we can start to build up, a picture of how the change must be occurring. I'm thinking about these, about this kind of like the way NMR spectroscopists or EPR spectroscopists think about things, that those short distance interactions that we pick up, for example, with bimane quenching, are a lot like spin-spin coupling in EPR. They tell you one constraint. They tell you the dynamics of the constraint, which is really nice, but there's really only one, we only have one at the moment. And it's really the combination of those that ultimately will present some picture to us on what's actually happening. And at the moment, we're just trying to get the technique to work well enough that we believe what's happening. But that is the goal. Yeah. So we know in retrospect. For example, in this, I didn't mention it. Let me see if I go back here. Obviously, because of fret's very steep distance dependence, you tend to really emphasize whichever the closest one is, whatever the closest fluorophore is. And so you say, oh, well, here's four fluorophores that all look pretty close. But it turns out they're all not on the same subunit. So some of this is intra-subunit fret. This is inter-subunit fret. The closest one happens to be on the same subunit. This one we can't tell because we know they're all very close to each other. But some of them are inter-subunit and some of them are intra-subunit. And it has to do with the fact that in this channel, keep going back, this channel has a property in its structure which is my favorite thing, which we call an elbow on the shoulder. So here's the N-terminus. And it's the first two helices are right here. That's the A-prime helix, turn, B-prime helix. So that looks like an elbow to us, and it's resting on two helices, which are the C and D of the blue, and its A and B are resting on the C and D of the green. So it looks like each subunit's kind of resting its elbow on its neighbor. So as a result, there's a big part of the yellow subunit, for example, that's hanging over the blue subunit. So sometimes the fret's going to be intersubunit, and sometimes it's intrasubunit. Yeah.
So if that's correct, with those distances, you should see a homofret signal, and it shouldn't change. Is that what you see?
I don't understand the question.
So you can have fret from GFD to another GFD, which you can look at with
anisogeny. Yeah.
If those things aren't moving, it should not change.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. No. So it closes either because this piece is exhibiting an inhibitory effect on it, pulling it closed. Okay, we think that's happening because this big elbow on the shoulder ring that's happening here is basically forming a tight noose that's holding the pore, which is attached right onto this ring. It's holding that pore closed. And so when the second nucleotide binds, it releases this noose and the pore is allowed to pop open. So that's one way it can close. The other way it can close is in a voltage-gated channel, that opening is also coupled to the movements of the voltage sensors. And so if the voltage sensors are in their, in the case of HCN channels, are in their up position, that has an energetic effect separate from the one I'm showing you that stabilizes the closed conformation.
Thank you, Bill, again.
Thank you. Oh.
Okay.